Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to welcome to the microphones, actually to her telephone, Sharon Morrissey. Sharon's Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Consumer Agent. We're really pleased to have her with us today. And you can, of course, join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Sharon Morrissey, welcome.
Thank you very much. And spring is around the corner, Larry.
Oh, man. Well, next week, I'm told that things are supposed to get better, and we're starting to lose snow next week.
Yeah. And, you know, that rain and a little bit of warming over the weekend did help to at least lower the snow banks.
Yeah, I lowered it a little bit, but I tell you, not low enough for me.
No.
I'm sure you're getting calls regardless of the fact that it's miserable. It's been miserable and cold outside.
Yeah, I think everybody's anxious to get out there and get going. They're doing a lot of planning. They realize that, you know, this is Wisconsin winter, and now is the time to start preparing. We've got lots of classes and programs and things going on, too. So I know gardeners are out there, you know, kind of boning up on more gardening knowledge and getting ready for the season.
Yeah, and I know there's a couple of events coming up, and we'll be sure to get to those. I know there's something at Burner and Botanical Gardens, and there's also something else, a natural landscaping and yard care conference or event as well. We'll talk about those as we go along here. But
all right, good.
Let's take a call first. Mary in Fond du Lac called early, and she's been waiting. So let's go to Mary. Hi, Mary.
Hi there, Larry and Sharon.
Hi.
I have a problem with Christmas cactuses that are in, well, actually, they're all in the same room. It's on a west window. The newer ones, which are kind of different colors that I hadn't had before that I got at Leaflets, are
green,
purple.
Oh, they're purple. Okay.
Whereas my older one is green.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I've seen that happen on Christmas cactus. And, you know, I think it might have to do with cool temperatures and also with fertilizer. I think when there is low phosphorus, it's either phosphorus or potassium, that can cause that purpling of foliage colors in any plants, really. But I think it's a combination of the two in Christmas cactus. Is the room kind of chilly?
Well, we're not living there, so the temperature is probably 55 for sure.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And are the other plants green?
Well, the one is green, and I have some Moses in the Pulpit,
mm-hmm.
which is just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then a spider plant, which keeps struggling, but it's not because it's cold. He has scale on it, and it just kind of keeps fighting it.
Well, 55 is kind of cold for most of our interior plants, even though a lot of them can go down to 60, and they actually appreciate that fluctuation in temperature between a daytime temperature and a nighttime temperature. 55 is really kind of pushing it, though. So I would expect that with that Christmas cactus, the ones that have the purplish leaves, that purplish maroonish color is from the cold temperatures, and poor fertility. Now, it might just be that because of the cold temperatures, they're not taking up the fertilizer as well and utilizing it as well, too. So I think you could probably solve some of that just by warming things up a little bit for them. And that will happen kind of naturally soon.
We hope. We sure hope. Thanks, Mary. Good luck. Appreciate the call. Matt in Hatfield. We'll go to you now. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. Hi, Larry and Sharon. How are you?
Great.
Good.
Good. I recently started a garden 2 years ago. And I ordered a load of topsoil, but I think it's merely sweet sand. Are you familiar with that term?
No, I'm not.
Okay. I live up in sand country in central Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
and it's just that 1 or 2 inches of soil that has the nutrients right on top. But the thing is, I can't grow, like, a decent weed in this thing. and I was wondering what you might think.
Boy, not being familiar with sweet sand and sandy soils very much, you know, the main thing I know about sandy soils is that with both sandy and clay soils, the best way to improve those soils is by adding organic matter. What could prevent you from growing in this particular topsoil, I really don't know. It depends on what it was used for before. You would suspect maybe excess nutrients or maybe no nutrients whatsoever. But as you were saying, it was the top 1 to 2 inches of sandy soil that has a lot of nutrients in it?
I would think so, but it's also, you know, the water tends to set on top of it for a while. So does that say clay or something like that?
It says not good.
Yeah, that would make you wonder about the subsoil and whether there's a poor drainage there. A soil test, I guess, is the first recommendation.
Okay.
And you can do that now. It takes a little bit longer in the spring, so many people are sending in soil samples, but you can take a soil sample and send that to the soils lab in Madison, and they can give you an idea of what's going on with the soil, what nutrients it may need, and they'll also ask you which crops you're going to be growing so they can make recommendations for those particular crops. So I guess that would be what I'd suggest first. And you also talk to the source where you got the topsoil and find out more about the soil that you got from them.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like the best soil in the world.
No, it's not.
Yeah, if it's sandy and it's puddling, that
kind of
raises a red flag.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much, and I'll go get that test.
Yeah, get the test. And what's probably going to tell you is you're going to need to build up the organic matter in that soil, I would bet, Sharon. And there's ways to do that.
Yes, I'm really adding any form of organic matter, composted manure, garden compost itself, leaf mold, peat moss, all of those things will help to add organic matter that helps the water-holding capacity and the nutrient-holding capacity of soils, and it's particularly helpful with sandy soils.
Absolutely. Good luck, Matt. Thank you very much for calling. Terry in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Larry. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I have kind of a general waking up the garden and the lawn after all this snow question.
Mm-hmm.
I have still some leaves on my lawn, and I have talked to a couple of lawn people who say to wait until it dries before doing anything, but with the leaves on it, shouldn't I be doing some, once the snow comes off, shouldn't I be doing some...
getting rid of the leaves? How heavy is the... Is it a thick layer?
No, it isn't. It's scattered.
Mm-hmm.
In some places, like around trees and bulbs and stuff.
It's a little thicker.
It's thicker, yes.
Yeah. And I wouldn't see that there would be a problem with taking those leaves off as soon as the snow has melted.
Okay.
And in a lawn situation... That certainly will help because it'll get the sunlight to the grass plants as they're starting to regrow. If you were to leave those leaves on there, they wouldn't get the sunlight. That would hold the moisture in. It may prevent it from thawing underneath, too. I guess I'd just make sure that it is pretty well thawed before you do that. Maybe that's the reservation they have about having you do it too early, is that the grass would be frozen still and you might do some damage. So as long as you wait until the soil has thawed completely to remove those leaves.
Okay, so that'll be June.
Hmm? Well, hopefully May. We hope May. We hope April.
I'm trying to be a little
But it might be June.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Terry. Thanks for calling. Anna in Marinette, your turn. Hi, Anna.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I have one comment and then one question for you. As an Arisat Master Gardener with the Extension office up here in Marinette, I want to put a plug in for our upcoming Spring Garden Conference.
Okay.
Which, needless to say, is always a fabulous event. So folks can just go through the Extension and find the specifics for that. Now, my question for you, Sharon, and Larry, of course, is we've been blessed with a lot of snow this year. And in your opinions and your scientific and other opinions, how is this going to impact plant life this year? Because with the drought we've had for so long, I'm hoping that this year somehow my gardens are going to be a little bit happier.
Yeah.
Is that a reasonable assumption to make?
Well, it really depends, and we could probably start every answer with that. Well, it really depends. But there are definitely advantages and disadvantages to the weather that we had. I guess the advantages to having snow cover is that snow does insulate plant material. So when we had the very, very cold temperatures, it helps to insulate them and prevent them from being affected by those extremely cold temperatures. But and it also, once it melts down, provides a lot more moisture. And so if you know that has been lacking, that's a good thing, too. And it's good to get some moisture in the spring, depending on how much natural rain we get to add to that moisture and whether the soils then become flooded. So that would be a downside of having too much snow in the spring. Another downside to all that snow is that I think we're going to see a lot of physical damage to trees and shrubs, particularly, and not so much perennials and ground covers and things, but trees and shrubs, definitely, from the weight of the snow. And also, in January, I don't know about the entire state, but certainly down here in southeastern Wisconsin, we had a serious thaw, and it got very, very warm. In fact, there were tornadoes. And very suddenly, it got very cold again. So the warmth isn't the problem. It's when it gets very cold very quickly again, and there was no snow cover at that time.
Yeah, and then you got ice.
Then you've got ice, and you've got those freezing temperatures affecting the entire plant.
Sure.
So it's real hard to say, but all of those things are factors that affect how much damage the winter's going to do or how good the winter was for our plant. So it'll be very interesting to watch and then to really evaluate the areas where you see things happening as to why they're happening and whether the weather has affected that or not.
Yeah.
Right. It'll be an interesting spring.
It will be. Take a look at the lawns, too. Snow mold might be a problem this year, too, on lawns. So there's
especially where snow stays for any length of time.
Yep. That's right.
Well, thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Anna. Thanks very much for calling. We have some open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly here as we visit with Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Agent. Glad to have her along and happy to have you listening in. Here's that number. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. Give us a call. We'll get you on pretty fast. Nate in Madison, your turn. Hi, Nate.
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm a new homeowner, and I've unfortunately got one of those barren suburban yards that comes with half of it sodded and half of it not.
Mm-hmm.
I've got two questions. I want to put a hedge. I have a corner lot, so it's a side yard. And so you can see a lot of our yard from the street, as well as our neighbor is pretty much full view of our yard, too. And I wanted to build a hedge, and I was just wondering what you would suggest for something that grows tall and narrow, because I don't have the largest lot in the world.
Yeah. Tall and narrow is a problem for hedges.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very difficult to find plants that there really aren't many things to choose from that are naturally tall and narrow. And so pruning often needs to be done to keep them in shape, and then that adds to the maintenance of the property, and so it's not necessarily very desirable. There are some arborvitaes that can be used, and those are evergreen, white cedars, some people call them. There are some cultivars that are quite narrow and grow quite tall. They may be a little difficult to keep them the height that you want, though, because they're going to want to grow about 30 or 40 feet tall. So you would need to prune the tops, and then that would make it a hedge that needs pruning anyway. It doesn't necessarily need to be an evergreen in order to be a good screen, even though you can see through a deciduous hedge that still can provide sort of that impression of privacy, even in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, there aren't a lot of real tall, narrow, deciduous plants either.
Right.
The hedge cotoneaster is a pretty decent choice because often hedges go through areas that are sunny and then shady and sunny and shady, and cotoneaster can tolerate that. Cotoneasters can also tolerate high pH soils, alkaline soils. And I don't think Madison area is as bad as it is down here in southeastern Wisconsin, but we definitely have very alkaline soils here. And cotoneasters have a nice crisp green leaf. What's called the hedge cotoneaster is of a more upright habit, but it still naturally grows to about 5 or 6 feet wide, maybe even more. So it's still going to require some pruning.
You know, one other thing you might do is sort of mix in is some trellising, where you put some higher trellises, and you could do some climbing vines.
That's a good idea.
Then they're there all year, and they don't take up a lot of space. I don't know. Sharon, what do you think of that idea?
Yeah, that sounds good, too. And there are a lot of vines that can be used. There's also, fencing may be the option for you. It may be a long stretch that is being fenced, but fencing may be a better option for you if you have a very narrow area, very small area to put this in.
Well, and then the other question I had is when, if I'm going to do some of the arborvitaes or the hedge, the
peony aster,
what is the best time to plant them if I have a yard that is seeded, and they seeded it late in the year, and so I'm with the winds and stuff that picked up a lot of, I feel like a lot of the seeds blew off. And so not only do I have to plant the hedges, but I also am going to have to seed a yard, and I'm wondering if that's going to involve some Roundup to get rid of, like, crabgrass, like, you know, Mayish, and then reseed it for the summer, or what are your suggestions for that?
Well, that depends. With seeding a lawn in the spring, you are going to have to get something down to hold the soil, although seeding in the fall is a better time to do it where you have less competition from weeds. If there are a lot of weeds already there, you should deal with those weeds before you do the seeding, however. Yeah. And to do that, yeah, something like Roundup is going to be the best thing. But if you use Roundup on the weeds in the lawn areas, even if you are planting shrubs into that area, if Roundup isn't sprayed on the shrubs, it shouldn't affect the shrubs.
Okay. So
it doesn't get into the soil.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as you protect.
That's right. Right.
Okay.
You might want to kind of wait and see what comes up, too. If it was a new lawn last fall, you said?
Yes. They sodded like the front and side yards. And
okay.
Then
and then
our
they
main egg yard, they put straw and seed down.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to use Roundup, you definitely need to wait until things are up and growing, because it's that vigorously growing plant that's going to take up the Roundup and actually be more effective. So don't do that too early anyway.
Good luck, Nate. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Agent. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sharon Morrissey, our guest today, answering your gardening questions. Pleased to have her along. And feel free to join in at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Dave in White Bear Lake, Minnesota is next. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your show, and I always learn a lot.
Thank you.
I have a kind of a strange question. I'm not privileged enough to have my own garden. I have to use a public plot.
Yep.
Being a public plot, I want to add something to the soil, inexpensively, of course, that would just boost the nutrition and nutrients and the growing power of the soil. Any ideas of what I could turn into the soil?
Are you going to be having the same plot over time, or just going to be 1 year deal? Or
unfortunately, there's no guarantee to get the same plot every year.
Okay.
So that's why I want something inexpensive to turn into the soil.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Sharon?
Well, if you're looking at adding organic matter, most organic matter doesn't have a lot of nutrient content, but it does help hold the nutrients that you then add in other ways. So you can add municipal compost from a municipal recycling yard is
okay.
Probably one of the best sources of cheap organic matter. It's free for the hauling, usually,
okay.
And has been pretty well composted through their windrowing process at the municipal yard, so that's a pretty safe bet. Also, any compost that's being produced by you or friends would be appropriate, too.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're probably going to have to buy it. Or if you have a source of manure and composted manure, that if it's free for the hauling, there again, you've got a nice cheap source. And that would be higher in nutrients probably than the municipal compost. But anything you can do to add organic matter is going to aid in the nutrient holding capacity of the soil.
Yeah.
Okay. What would you think about turning Miracle-Gro into the soil as I turn it over?
Well, that's not really how Miracle-Gro is intended to be used. It's a soluble fertilizer that's designed to be dissolved in water and then used to water the plants.
Okay.
So Miracle-Gro would not be the thing to use. But if you're going to use a granular fertilizer, granular fertilizers are designed to broadcast over the surface of the soil and then lightly work them in, not work them in deeply, because they need to be where the roots of the plants are going to be when you put the plants in. So a granular fertilizer at the time of planting, broadcast over the garden, and then lightly incorporated in by just using a garden rake and running it across the ground once the soil is all prepared and ready to go. then put the fertilizer down, run the garden rake over it, and that should be sufficient.
And that'll be less expensive than Miracle-Gro, I can tell you that.
Very much more expensive.
I'm sure. Thank you very much for your help. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Dave. Appreciate it very much. Not that Miracle-Gro isn't a good product, but if you're thinking about applying it on a whole garden, it can get expensive.
It can, and, you know, with fertilizers in general, the more convenient they are, the more expensive they are.
Yep.
Just kind of works that way.
Oh, boy. Lois and Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Lois.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to comment for the person who's trying to grow on sand. I've lived in the Wisconsin River Valley for 18 years, during which time my husband has added literally tons of manure to that garden plot, which makes it better. But the problem of puddling still exists, and this just takes time. Each time you are trying to water the garden, put the water on, it'll puddle, turn the water off, let that water soak in. When it's soaked in, turn the water on, let it puddle, and let it soak in. Eventually, your sand will be moist enough so that the water you're adding will soak down to those roots. But when it's really dry, you just have to keep putting it on slowly so that it has a chance to soak in.
That makes good sense to
very
me.
Interesting, yes.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks, Lois.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call very much. You know, in celebration of trees, before we go back to the phones here, Sharon, Arbor Day, there's an Arbor Day celebration at Berner Botanical Gardens and the Weir Nature Center.
Yes, it's going to be a spectacular event. It's the first year for this celebration, and it's being held at both Berner Botanical Gardens and the Weir Nature Center, which are both in Whitnall Park, which is one of the Milwaukee County parks. And there are just all kinds of activities involved for that weekend. It's on April 19th and 20th. And for details about it, you can go to the Berner Botanical Garden website, which is just www.berner, B-O-E-R-N-E-R, botanicalgardens.org. There will be speakers, there will be activities, there will be a scavenger hunt, there will be nature walks that go from the Botanic Gardens over to the Nature Center. We're having tree planting ceremonies by a whole host of groups and individuals. We have dignitaries from the area coming to help plant those trees and celebrate the trees of Whitnall Park and the rest of our state, because Arbor Day is coming up. The following Friday is National and Wisconsin's Arbor Day. So it's going to be a great event. It runs from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday, the 19th of April, and from noon to 4 on Sunday, the 20th of April. And a lot of the specialists that, Larry, you have on your show from UW Extension will be there giving presentations on a whole range of topics having to do with trees.
And I tell you, the Nature Center and the Berner Botanic Gardens are just, it's a great place to visit. I've been there many times and enjoyed every visit. Beautiful place.
Beautiful resources, and we're sure it's going to be just a gorgeous weekend.
No snow?
We're not guaranteeing it.
No snow, hopefully. Oh, boy. Kathy in Appleton will give you a chance now. Hi, Kathy.
Good morning, Larry and Sharon. Thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Sure.
I am calling about a couple topics, and you may have touched on one of them in another fashion. I have some knockout roses in the front yard, which are truly knockout roses. They are so abundant and flowering all year, and I don't remember what comment you made about them wintering a winter like this.
Well, I didn't really comment at this time yet, but there has been kind of mixed reviews of the winter hardiness of knockout roses.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yes, it generally is pretty darn hardy. It sometimes, however, does die back down to the ground, and you'll have to kind of wait and see what happens. The snow cover that we had is going to be very helpful for them. And that will help to protect, even if just the lowest couple inches of the stems survive, that will have live buds that can then branch out and produce a whole new shrub for you. And fortunately, roses do flower on new wood, so any of the growth that occurs this summer will then flower this summer. They just may be a little bit smaller plant because they've died back somewhat. So it's definitely going to be a wait and see. It'll depend on the location that they're in, how exposed to cold they were, how well hydrated they were going into the season. If the soil is too wet or too dry, you know, they could be stressed. And that's true with most plants. But we'll just have to kind of wait and see with those.
And then typically when there is a thaw and we can actually see them again, and then the weather warms up enough, are they to be cut back significantly?
They only need to be cut back as far as they need to be cut back. You only need to cut back to the part where it's died back to. And since we don't really recommend winter protection for knockout roses, they are a hardy shrub rose generally, then you leave the branches up all winter long, and then in the spring, you kind of can tell where the stems are still green and where they're not. If it's real obvious visually, then to cut back just to where they're green.
Sure.
Once you cut back there, you can look at the interior of that stem, and if it's brown in the center, then you know that that portion is still dead a little ways further back. So cut again. If you wait a little longer, though, you'll see where the buds start to break and open up. And as long as buds are breaking and opening, that portion of the stem is live.
Okay. Well, they've been so well. It's our third year, so
they've been good
so far. One other quick question. This is about an indoor plant, a jade plant. The gentleman who had an orchid growing business had a jade plant that must have been all of 5 feet tall in his front waiting area. His cat would sleep in it. And it broke off one of the larger branches, and he said, "Do you want it?" And I said, "Well, explain to me what I would do with this." And he said, "Just let it scab over. Just let it sit for at least 2-3 weeks, if not more, and let it scab over and stick it in the dirt."
Mm-hmm.
I did that, and it's actually flourishing, but there I'm seeing these little, what look like very, very tiny white snowballs. Are those, like, and they're all over the leaves? They're at the joints?
Yeah, that's probably mealybug.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an insect that forms this cottony mass over it. And right at the joint where the leaf attaches to the stem is the most common place to see them. But once the infection has become, or the infestation has become large, they kind of move all over the stems and leaves. What do you do about it, right?
Right.
You can use, well, mealybug can be treated with insecticidal soaps. They can also be treated with ultrafine oils. But I would check on both of those products to make sure that jade is not hypersensitive to those products. They're both low toxicity products, and the oil ends up smothering the insects. So you're spraying it on, but it's a very lightweight oil. It's not like dormant oil. It's a very lightweight oil for use on plants that have live green leafy tissue on them. But read the label very carefully to make sure that jade plant isn't suggested as one that you don't use it on.
Oh.
All right.
That's great.
And when you're at the point where you have, you know, if you see these right away and there's only a few of them on the plant, you can kind of rub them off. People often say use a Q-tip dipped in alcohol and wipe them off. On a big plant with lots of them on there, that becomes a big project. Plus, the young, the nymphs, are so tiny, and they're very translucent. You can't really see them, so all you're really getting are the adults. And then the nymphs turn into adults, and the problem persists. So it probably is one that you'd want to use an insecticide to treat.
Okay, well, that's what I'll try. And can I ask one more real quick question? Actually, it's a comment.
Sure.
My son in fifth grade, and he's now a sophomore, brought home in a little plastic cup part of a jade plant. Mm-hmm. Most of his friends I found out through There's a Way after so long. Well, I kept his. I repotted it and kept it. I now have 5 enormous spider plants from it. And I don't have a green thumb, but they're close to the jade. Are they susceptible to?
Yes.
Yes.
That is a problem with interior plants. A lot of the insect pests that infect them are generalists, and so they will go to other plants.
Then I ought to treat all of them.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in to it, 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890. Carol in Galena, Illinois, you are next. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Sharon.
Hey.
Larry, great show as always. And Sharon, I love when you're on. You have such a calm way of explaining all these problems that people are just trying to find out how to solve.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. You know, you've mentioned adding compost, and I'm an organic gardener. I have three composters going. I have animals, so I have lots of manure and garden waste, and I keep adding compost because I have a lot. How much is too much? When do I stop?
Well, apparently, that's a very good question, and it's a question we asked about our community gardens at one point because we did have a large supply of compost of various kinds. And we asked our soil scientists if there was a point where we could put too much on, and the answer was no.
No.
You really can't because it's constantly breaking down. It breaks down all the time, so you're always losing some at the same time that you're applying some. So as long as it's still breaking down, you know, you're going to be losing a little, and apparently you can't put too much on. Now, the ideal soil would have between 2 and 5% organic matter. I've looked at soil test reports that have come back for gardens from our area, and there have been gardens that have 15 and 20% organic matter, doing just fine, no problem. So, yes, by adding it all the time, you are going to have a very high level of organic matter, but as far as I know, there's no that's not detrimental in any way.
Oh, that's wonderful. I have the master gardeners in Joe Davies County, where Galena and Elizabeth, you know, all these few towns exist. They're having a seminar on Saturday, March 15th, called Growing of the Green at the Elizabeth, in Elizabeth, Illinois, on Route 20 at the Area Vocational College. And it's Saturday morning and through lunch, and I'd like to invite your listeners to come.
I'd be glad to have them invited. Thank you, Carol.
Very good.
If they have questions, they can call the Joe Davies Extension Office.
Very good.
Joe Davies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your help.
And stay listening, Carol. Stay listening. 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. By the way, I was looking around here. Apparently, you can use rubbing alcohol a little bit on jade, as we were talking about that a little bit earlier. So that's something that...
But I wouldn't want to recommend that people spray it over the pesticide.
No, you'd want to use a Q-tip or something.
Right. So, you know, if you can do that, you can physically get at it and have the time to do it, because if there are a lot of mealybugs on it could be very time-consuming. That can be helpful for the ones that you actually put the alcohol on.
Carol in Hudson, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Good to talk to you, Sharon and Larry. I'm looking to add some color and as well as height to my gardens this summer, and I was thinking, what actually is the kind of the growth limit for climate where I could grow a redbud tree and a Japanese maple? Can I grow those up here in Hudson? It's kind of a climate zone 4A, they say.
That's real iffy for both.
Yeah.
But there are microclimates on all of our properties. So in a microclimate is an area that's protected in some way, or where there's more penetration of maybe solar energy, so that it's not really the 4A climate zone. It makes a warmer climate zone than that. Redbud is very iffy even here in 5, and Japanese maple is the same thing. There may be some Japanese maple cultivars that have been selected because they're hardier. I know there are a couple. There is one species, I think, the full moon maple, I think, is one of the ones, but don't quote me on that, that's a little bit hardier. So if you kind of looked around for a hardier variety of Japanese maple, you might do okay. But you really are pushing it. You've got to have that microclimate and a hardy variety.
Would protecting them in winter make any difference?
No. Not really. Not very feasible to do for either one of them.
Okay.
Because it's the exposure of the stems, the wood, the bark, and the sensitivity of the cambium layer that's underneath and the buds that are exposed during the winter. And it's not very likely that you'd be able to cover the entire plant. They're both trees.
All right. Is there anything else, any other type of tree that would be suitable up here and would provide similar color?
Well, between the two, I mean, they're two different plants, very different plants. The redbud has two features. One of them is those bright fuchsia pink flowers that come right out of the bark, right out of the stems in little clusters, so it makes this outline of pink in the spring. But then once those flowers are gone, you have nice heart-shaped, large heart-shaped leaves. Nothing else quite like that nice heart, large heart-shaped leaf. But the Katsura tree does have heart-shaped leaves. They don't get quite as large. It doesn't really have any ornamental flowering characteristics. But Katsura tree is hardier, so that would be nice for heart-shaped leaves, and they are relatively reliable.
And the full moon maple, I'm thinking, is about a 5A top zone. It's about 5A. So that'd be kind of iffy.
Yeah. There are lots and lots of Japanese maple species and cultivars of those species, and so I guess I'd just do an internet for some hardy varieties. And something else that might replace that, similar fine texture, but you know, nothing that's a true replacement for a Japanese maple. A similar fine texture might be the... it's a maple, the Trident maple.
Oh, yeah.
Trident maple. It's the paper bark maple.
Mm-hmm.
It has a nice...
Pretty
also
tree.
Teterica, Acer Teterica. Hedge maple. That's another one that has sort of a little bit more fine textured foliage, so it would be a little bit more like the Japanese maple. But serviceberry, juneberry, ameleager is a very nice, hardy, spring flowering, early summer fruiting, good fall color, small tree that you wouldn't even have to worry about protecting.
Yeah, it's another one.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension, Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Agent, our guest here today on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest by way of telephone, Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Agent, really pleased to have her along, and certainly you can join in too at 800-642-1234 in the Madison area at 263-1890. Carol in Eau Claire is next. Hi, Carol.
Actually, it's Carl.
Oh, Carl. Well, Carol and Carl, well, you know, I should clean my glasses off a little bit. Jim Packard wrote Carl down for me, and I said Carol.
You had three in a row. I don't blame you. About the sandy soil, you know, up here, there's many surrounding areas around here, we have lots of sandy soil also, and the watering issue, but also it's got to do with compost and getting organic matter into the soil. One of the things myself and others have found is that if you can find a cheap and free source of sawdust, and when you're working your soil up either for the very first time, or once every couple of years, you work sawdust in deep below your compost layer. And that loosens up the top. It also holds water, and it'll absorb water downward. And it also gets you through some of the drought periods in the later summer because it's helping hold water in the soil. And also just a bag of real cheap peat moss, a $4 bag of cheap peat moss, spread over in the springtime, just over it and worked in.
Helps out, but you know the sawdust. You know that's something that can tie up nitrogen in the soil.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking too. So you just have to make sure that you're doing a little extra nitrogen fertilization.
Right.
Yeah, but you're bringing it. Well, the idea of the sawdust is to get it below the compost layer. When you're initially setting up your garden, you dig out. If you got the machinery, or you can get a farmer to come in, or you can get somebody rent machinery to bring in, you can get it down 10, 12 inches. And then get the organic matter over the top of it. What you're doing is you're breaking up that hard stand soil down below.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pulling water and not puddling it. And as it gets past that hard sand layer below, the water just poof, gone.
Uh-huh.
It goes deep on you. Where the sand will, sawdust does the trick is it helps draw the water into the compost and holds the water moisture there instead of just making it disappear into the substrate below.
I see. Yeah, I wondered, actually, if there was sort of an interface between a really kind of a hard pan of hard-packed sandy soil underneath the worked soil on top.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you have water that sheets along that hard pan, and then it can end up puddling.
Once it gets past that hard pan, then it just disappears, like pouring it into a glass, into a pipe. That's what the sawdust will help. The sawdust, if your hard pan is shallow and you break through that hard pan, then you replace that hard pan with a good layer of sawdust mixed with loose sand and compost, and then you put your composted layer, your organic layer, over the top of that.
And how long have you been gardening in sandy soil?
Long enough to know that, huh?
Not long enough, but long enough to know that it's an old trick that I learned from farmers who were setting, you know, for their home gardens. Because they, you know, the water just disappears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they got to hold the water during the drought time, but they don't want it to puddle during the plentiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a joke about farming on sandy soils that you can plow in the rain because it just goes right into the ground anyway.
Yep. You're not going to get stuck.
Right.
Thanks, Carl.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. All right. Let's hear from Rebecca in Black Earth next. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I have about 15 mature lilac trees lining our driveway, and I'm guessing they're 15 years old because that's when they're about 12 years old. That's when the house was built. We bought the house 4 years ago in the spring, and they all bloomed beautifully. Apparently, the former owners used to have a lawn service come to spray. I'm not exactly sure for what. In any case, I don't do that. And I've noticed over the last few years, fewer blooms. And the most important thing is that there appears to be some kind of scale on the trunks of the lilac trees. And I'm wondering if you know anything about that.
Well, there's probably a lot of things going on there. It may or may not be related at all to the lawn service or to the fact that you've changed your practices from what they were before. The plants themselves have just gotten older as part of it, older and more mature. And as they get older and more mature, if they're not properly pruned and sort of re-stimulated, then they can diminish in flowering over time. The pruning that we recommend to combat that or to offset that is called rejuvenation pruning or even renewal pruning. Renewal pruning would be where you'd cut it out some of the largest stems in the plant every year, just one or two or three of the largest stems, and that will stimulate new growth from the root system, and that will be more vigorous growth that will then end up flowering. rejuvenation pruning is if it's really gotten to the point where there's no flowers at all, hardly, or you have big, old, gnarly trunks that only flower up at the top, which is a characteristic sign of an old lilac, then you would cut those down completely, and you would do it in the spring before they flower, and you would go into the ground and do a little bit of root pruning. Take a spade and go into the ground in a couple of places around the crown to stimulate those roots. Now, your plants being 12 years old, they may be getting to that point if they haven't had much stimulus over these last 12 years. And so it's just starting to show up now that they look like they're declining. And it's just maturity and that they need to be stimulated somewhat through some pruning.
Okay.
As far as a scale, I believe there is a scale that affects lilacs. And for that, I guess I would, what you're looking for is about a 16th of an inch, 8th of an inch, rounded, hard-shelled, looks sort of like popcorn hull, the hull of a popcorn seed, you know? And you look for those on the newest growth and on the older growth, but on the newest growth, you'd see that more clearly because these scale insects tend to move out from under the mother's scale that's protecting them, and then they move toward the growing point, the tip, where the tissue is more tender. So you'll see it more on the fresher, newer growth. Look for that. Then there is a specific timing for treating scale on lilacs, and I don't right off the top of my head know what that is. We do have extension publications that give that information on the Learning Store website, you can get our publication on woody ornamental plant pest management.
Okay.
And that will tell you when to treat and what to use. You can generally use insecticidal soaps if you treat at the right time when those little crawlers come out from under the mother's shell where they're protected. Then they come out, they have no shell, and they're then exposed to the insecticidal soap. But you have to know the timing for doing that. I'm not exactly sure what that is.
Okay.
Okay.
And should I be watering my lilacs?
Well, it depends on what the weather conditions have been like and what your soil is like. Supplemental water is always recommended during drought periods, and an inch of water a week is what kind of the rule of thumb is for most of our outdoor plants, lawns and trees and shrubs and flowers. But they're not really, really sensitive to dry temperature, dry conditions. Should you be watering them? I guess putting a mulch on them to hold moisture in longer certainly will help. It'll make the soil more organic and more porous if it's a clay soil. It'll also improve sandy soil. So I guess I would mulch first. A couple of inches of wood chip mulch or shredded bark mulch over the root zone, as much of the root zone as you can.
Okay.
Great.
And the Learning Store website is just learningstore.uwex.edu.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Do we have to do the HTTP for that before we do that? I think we might have to do HTTP. No?
No, I don't think so. I think you can just type in learningstore.uwex.edu and it'll go.
I'll try it and see if it works.
Okay, good.
Thanks again, Rebecca. And Kim, I believe in Madison, has been waiting a while. So let's go to Kim. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about planting a dwarf fruit tree. We'd like to plant a tree in our backyard. And I guess I'm trying to choose first what type of fruit and then a variety. We were thinking between like a pear or cherry tree. And my understanding is that you need at least two pear trees to get fruit. Is that right?
I can look that up while you're talking.
I think that's true, but one of my neighbors has a couple pear trees, and they're maybe like 100 feet away or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if that would work for pollination.
Yeah.
Is that close enough?
Yes, that would definitely work.
Okay, so I could do either then pear or cherry.
Yeah, the cherry trees, we recommend the tart cherry over the sweet cherry from Wisconsin, for most of Wisconsin. You could try sweet cherry, but they're not as hardy. And with the sweet cherry, I think there is a pollination requirement for that. And I'm kind of looking for our publications. We have some great publications on fruits, all available through the Learning Store. There is one on cherries, peaches, plums, and apricots in Wisconsin. And then the pest management brochure that goes with that one. And it will tell you some information about varieties. It definitely tells you pollination information. And I have that right here. Let's see. Tart cherries, they are self-pollinating, so you don't have to worry about it. And sweet cherries, they require cross-pollination. And there is also...
I would have to have two sweet cherry trees if we were going to do that.
Right.
Okay.
And there's also a publication on fruit cultivars for southern Wisconsin and for northern Wisconsin that will tell you which of the cultivars are recommended for your area. So you're in the Madison area. I have the Southern Fruit Cultivars publication right here for tart cherries, and they only recommend tart cherries in here.
Oh, interesting.
They do not require cross-pollination.
Well, I think then we're going to lean towards pear.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I can make that many pies.
And if you have the space for it or not. For pears, it says to plant at least two cultivars to provide for cross-pollination and adequate fruit set, but your neighbor's tree would provide that pollination. The cultivars that are recommended for southern Wisconsin are Parker, Bartlett, and Gourmet, Patton, P-A-T-T-E-N, Luscious, and Flemish Beauty. Those are the ones that are listed in the publication. But do go to the Learning Store website and go to the Growing Pears publication.
Yeah.
And take a look at that and see what's involved. There are not as many disease or insect problems with pears as there are with apples, so I'm glad you didn't say apple.
That makes it a little easier.
Yeah. And, same thing with cherries.
How far from the house would we have to plant a dwarf pear tree?
It depends on how dwarf it is. And that would, I don't think there are any reliably dwarfing rootstocks for pears, however.
Oh.
So I think most of the pear trees are going to be relatively large, maybe 40, 50 feet tall.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Don't want it too close to the house, Kim.
Definitely not. We don't have that big of a backyard.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Well, they wouldn't be necessarily quite that wide, but you would need more space for those because I don't think there are any good dwarfing rootstocks for pears, and that's what it usually requires is a good dwarfing rootstock.
Okay.
For fruit crop.
And when in the spring do we plant fruit trees generally?
Well, pretty much after the danger of frost has passed, in a sense. You know, the ground has to warm up. It has to dry out enough to dig the planting hole. You probably could plant a dormant plant at that point, but the problem is if it's in an area where it's going to be subjected to potentially late freezes, then the new growth could get zapped very easily. So you might want to wait until the middle of May, end of May to plant so that you don't run that risk. Because I think the 50% frost-free day is the first week of May, and that's just a 50% chance that you won't have another frost.
Right.
So, yeah, mid to late May probably.
Oh, well, great. Thank you for your help.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Sharon Morrissey, our guest today, UW Extension, Milwaukee County, UW Extension Horticulture Agent. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Sharon Morrissey, Milwaukee County, UW Extension Horticulture Agent. And I tell you what, we can talk about all kinds of things during this next half hour. Look forward to some questions on growing sweet cherries, and we've got some questions on yucca and on rototilling. What about you? Maybe you've got a question for us, and I hope you do, and I hope you'll give us a call. I know we also want to talk about there's some great meetings coming up, one on earth-friendly approaches to a healthy lawn in the Milwaukee area, another one on natural landscaping, so we'll visit about those with you, too. But if you have a question of your own, please feel free to join us at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. And we'll be back with Sharon Morrissey right after this look at the news. Stay with us. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest by way of telephone, Sharon Morrissey, who is our Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Really glad to have her with us today and certainly happy to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And Virginia in Oshkosh has a question for you.
Greetings to both of you.
Greetings to you.
I have a terrace in my front yard that, thanks to the DOT, is now only 30 inches wide. And our ag students at the high school have worked together with our community here to just, it's like 10 blocks, to provide us with free plants. And they dig up the terrace and plant them in. But every year they come through with a rototiller. And every year I see them digging up new roots to new weeds, and I think it should be just spaded over, and I just like an opinion on that.
Hmm. Wow. Well, it depends on a lot of things, doesn't it, Sharon?
Yeah, it sure does. And tilling is generally accepted to be done to an annual planting bed every year. The new roots to the new weeds that you're seeing in there, one of the things you're doing by tilling is turning under a lot of weed seeds that would be near enough to the surface that those seeds would germinate. So being
my point,
being deeper, but once those seeds go deeper, then they won't germinate. The ones that come up to the top will germinate, but you kind of end up exhausting that seed bank eventually if you keep the weeds down once the beds are planted. So if you keep the weeds down throughout the growing season, then new weed seeds aren't coming in. Well, so eventually you exhaust that seed bank.
I do put a lot of cocoa bean mulch on it because I like the smell. Mm-hmm. But they keep using the same flowers, petunias, zinnias, which get this mildew thing, and I think these little blue ageratum or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is that... Do they need more fertilizer now that they've been doing it 3 years in a row in the same place?
Well, it's not necessarily because they've been doing it in the same place for 3 years in a row. Annual flowers do need fertilizer every year. They should be fertilized a couple of times throughout the season. And that is the first year, the second year, the fifth year. You should fertilize the annuals every year several times during the growing season. For perennial flowers, you don't need to fertilize all the time. Actually, only once a year or every 3 years, I've heard the recommendation for perennial flowers. So the other thing about the weeds, though, that if there are perennial weeds in there whose root systems are being cut up by the tilling process, that's going to happen no matter what kind of soil bed preparation you're doing. So whether you're turning it over by hand or you're turning it over with a tiller, you're breaking up some of those. And so those perennial weeds have to be dealt with either by letting them grow up a little ways and then using a herbicide on them before the flowers are in, or hand-pulling and just constantly hand-pulling to exhaust their resources.
I keep having trouble with, it's some kind of a spreading, pretty little, it's a green spreading thing. It doesn't have any flowers on it. But the roots just keep breaking off, and they keep coming back and back, and they smother out everything at the ground level.
It could be Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, so I was thinking.
Heart-shaped
leaves.
Kind of a rounded leaf, rounded scalloped leaf with a little purple flower on it.
No, they're very tiny. It's all very tiny, spidery. Well, I'll deal with that, too.
Yeah.
The other question I have was, I've had a yucca in the south side of my house for almost 18 years, waiting for it to bloom, and I'm assuming it's a yucca like one of those century plant things. Maybe I'm using the wrong term. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't want to bloom. And if I dig it up, I'm afraid it's so old it'll just break off and die anyhow.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long it takes for yucca to flower, but they certainly should flower sooner than that. If we're talking about the same thing, it is a hardy plant, grows with spear-shaped leaves, sword-shaped leaves, and kind of a rosette coming up from the ground.
Yep.
And then they usually send up a flower spike that has white kind of bell-shaped flowers.
That's what I'm expecting, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Little ridges, little sharp ridges on the edge like a cactus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 3 feet in diameter, but nothing comes up.
Well, one thing about yucca I know is that they don't like really fertile soil.
Okay.
They prefer to have sandy soil, which usually isn't very fertile, and then it's also very, very well drained, and full sun. And so if you're not providing those conditions for it, if it's got heavier soil or some shade, that may be why you're not getting the flowering.
Definitely full sun, but it's more clay.
Mm-hmm. That may have something to do with it. And then generally, as far as digging it, moving it, I'm not sure if you can be very successful moving the mother plant, because I think you usually wait for offsets to form.
Never
so the youngest offsets from that main crown would be the best candidates to be moved.
Would they be like coming out of the bottom on the ground?
Yeah, they kind of come out and off of from the central point of the main rosette.
In the middle.
Yeah, but then they'll come underground, and on the outside edge of that rosette of leaves, you'll have another set of rosette of leaves.
Well, I've never seen it kind of like a spider plant would sprout out like that.
Well, except that it comes from underground.
Right.
Spider plant would be on a
out in the air.
Above ground.
Yeah, but I have not seen that happen. They just keep getting bigger leaves and getting bushier.
Yeah. Well, lower fertility, don't add any fertilizer.
Well, that probably would be a problem. I have been fertilizing incredibly flowers.
Okay. Yeah, maybe it, actually stop fertilizing. And then with clay soils, they're very nutrient-rich to begin with, and so the soil itself may be high in fertility. So it may take a little while for that to wear off.
So if I dig out some clay and throw in some sand?
No. We never recommend adding sand to a ground bed.
Oh.
The only time you would do that is if you can add 50% by volume sand to the bed, to the entire bed. And that's very, very difficult to do because that's an awful lot of sand. You can add sand to container soils, but you can't add sand to a ground bed.
Really?
Yeah.
There's reasons that the yucca flower is the state flower of New Mexico.
I got it. Well, I can't ship it, but I'll keep trying.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Virginia, for calling. David in Iron River, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question, and I guess I'm looking for an opinion. I have been a friend of mine picked some sweet cherries up in Bayfield, Wisconsin, which is as far north as you can get. And they kind of have a little microclimate there. And I'm wondering I'm going to try plant some. Iron River's about 50 miles from there, and I'm going to try plant some. Do you know of any kind that would be the kind that might grow as far north as you've ever heard? I'm looking for a variety.
Well, I do have the publication right here, Home Fruit Cultivars for Northern Wisconsin, and let me look and see if there is anything in cherries. No sweet cherries recommended, tart cherries only.
I see. Well, anyway, just I guess for your information, and I don't know, the kind that he said he was growing up there, and I know they did grow them because this friend of mine picked some and ate them, and it's called Lapins, L-A-P-I-N-S, which is a self-fertile variety. But I was wondering if you had any, ever heard of anybody else having success, because they do have the benefit of the lake surrounds.
That microclimate there.
It's the microclimate.
It
may not work. I just looked in the Home Fruit Cultivars for Southern Wisconsin, too, and there are no sweet cherries recommended there either. So,
or rats.
It's iffy, no matter what.
Well, okay.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, appreciate it. Bev and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Bev.
Hello. I'm wondering if you are familiar with a weed, the common name carpet weed? Mulligo verticillata?
Oh, my, she's even got the scientific name. I still don't, I'm not picturing it. Carpet weed, it could be a variety of things. How to describe it? It's a really, really tiny little roundish leaves.
Lays very flat on the ground, little tiny white flowers, and it creates a carpet. It's just a mat of weeds.
And does it seem to be attached at one point in the middle, and then those stems all grow out radiating from that center?
Right, and it's like impossible to pull. I'm sure it came into my vegetable garden with some compost that I purchased, and it just smothers out all the seedlings. Things like beans can get through it, but carrots, I just can't grow carrots anymore. I just don't know.
I think what you're referring to is also called prostrate knotweed. That's what I'm picturing, at least. And, you know, a couple of strategies with weeds. If it's a perennial weed that has a perennial root system where that root system survives from year to year, which may be the case with carpet weed, I'm not positive, then you really have to get that whole root system and kill that whole root system. By tilling in things like we were talking about with our earlier caller, you're breaking up those roots, and then each of those produces a new plant, so you can kind of make the situation worse. You may end up having to allow that bed to be fallow for a year and just do weed control for a year, so that every time the plant has grown up and sprouted and put on some green leafy tissue, you spray it with a herbicide to knock it back and let it grow back up again and knock it back and eventually exhaust its supplies of carbohydrate reserves so that it starves to death eventually. But that's something that's really hard to do while you're growing a crop, and you're kind of spot treating and directing your treatments right at the weeds as they come up, and you have to be just really diligent to do it.
Actually, I have tried that.
Oh, my.
And I was very unsuccessful.
It's miserable stuff to get rid of.
Right.
I know that for sure.
Hand pulling, mulching, and herbicides. I don't know what else can be done.
No, you've gone through the proper procedures there. I think you're getting rid. There's not much else you can do, and herbicides sometimes may be the only answer.
Right.
And there are some other herbicides. I'm thinking of our publication on lawn weed prevention and control, and in there, prostrate spurge or knotweed. Here's knotweed. Knotweed, they're saying, is an annual. And it is resistant to 2,4-D, which is like Weed Be Gone and probably one of the more common ones. It has intermediate susceptibility to Mecoprop, MCPP. It is susceptible to dicamba. So you would be looking for a product with the active ingredient dicamba for prostrate knotweed, if that's what it is. Up here is carpet weed.
Yeah.
That must be something completely different. It, too, is an annual. It is susceptible to 2,4-D. It is susceptible to Macaprop, and it is susceptible to dicamba. So any of those broadleaf weed killers you used on it should be effective with it.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if when I'm tilling it the next year, do you think some of the seeds have dropped and I'm just...
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it'll drop.
Yep, the seed and with an annual, that's definitely how it's coming back then, is from the seed dropping. And it has those teeny-weeny white flowers
right,
on it,
right.
And they produce seed.
Yep. Okay.
And if you walk around in it and then walk someplace else, you just drag it on to the next spot.
Oh, thanks.
Unfortunately, that's what happens with that stuff.
Okay.
So you have a couple months to plot strategy this year.
Yes, I do.
Good
thank
luck.
You.
Yep, thanks, Bev. Carol in Williams Bay, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm looking to do an earth-friendly lawn. I'm two blocks from Lake Geneva, and I'm very concerned about the chemicals going into the lake.
Mm-hmm.
It's the watershed from our property. Now, I notice that most of my neighbors use chemical services and so on. I have three-fourths of my lawn is pretty shady. And I just have lots of creeping Charlie and, of course, dandelions and plantain. Is there anything I can do that's healthy or earth-friendly?
To control the...
change, jig it all up?
Yeah, that's really the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah.
To kind of start over and make sure that then you control the weeds prior to reseeding. And
how? By just cutting them?
Well...
one thing you can do is have a healthy lawn. A healthy lawn, if you get rid of them once, isn't that true, Sharon? If you keep your lawn grass up 3-4 inches.
Uh-huh.
And a good vigorously growing lawn is the best defense against weeds and diseases and insects problems.
And even fertilizing that lawn, it'll hold the fertilizer and... you're going to probably be further ahead. I think some of the research, John Steyer said that some of the research shows that if you do fertilize the lawn, you're actually going to have less runoff problems than if you don't fertilize the lawn.
Well, I do fertilize it twice, but I just don't want to use that herbicide stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Last year I did once, and I felt guilty.
Well, there is a herbicide that is kind of, it's recommended with reservations, corn gluten meal.
Mm-hmm.
It does come from corn, and its success rate is kind of questionable sometimes, but over time, using it can provide some control for germination and preventing germination of weed seeds of a lot of our common weeds. It does not get rid of perennial weeds that are existing. But over time, if you can get the lawn growing more vigorously and then prevent germination of new seeds, you may be able to reduce your weed problem that way.
You know, and two, if you're interested in a lawn service, there are lawn services. I know there's at least one in Madison that is advertises itself as not using herbicides and finding other ways, eco-friendly ways to take care of lawns. And so you might do a little bit of searching around in your area, Carol, for anybody, a lawn service that may advertise that.
Mm-hmm. There is one that calls itself an organic, and they're really good. I don't know. But anyway...
The other thing to consider, though, is depending on how large the area is and what your resources are for doing this, is starting over and tilling the whole thing up and controlling the weeds one time,
mm-hmm.
getting rid of them all. Till it, allow them to grow, use a herbicide, they die back, let them grow again, hit it again,
mm-hmm.
and spend a year kind of doing that. And killing off all of those perennial weeds that are there. And then when you reseed the lawn, make sure you choose a very shade-tolerant lawn grass
mm-hmm.
and a high-quality seed and a good mixture of seed so you get a good start on that lawn again, and then keep it vigorously growing. And growing grass in the shade is quite different than growing it in the sun. You do use less fertilizer. You do mow less often. You do water less often. And all of those things will help to make it a more vigorous lawn. You don't treat it the same as you would in a sunny area.
Mm-hmm.
So those are your options.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Marcia in Bessemer, Michigan is up next. Hi, Marcia.
Good morning.
Morning.
Yes, my husband and I planted two red, blaze red maple trees about 7 years ago, and one of them is too close to the house, naturally. They're about 12 feet tall, and we want to move the one, and we don't know when or how or whatever to do it.
12 feet, wow. Huh?
That's relatively sizable plants.
They're about an inch in diameter.
I could still, you'd almost need to bring in, one of those spades?
Yeah, I would have it done professionally, I think, because the ratio of soil ball and roots to the height of the plant and the amount of canopy there is, it's pretty critical in moving it without doing too much damage and setting it back too much.
It might be more like 10 feet. I might have that mistaken.
And then it's got to be pretty good size. You know, when they dig a tree in the nursery, they don't just grow the tree in the nursery for a few years and then just go in and dig it out. They do a process of root pruning that helps to make more of the roots in the ball right next to the plant so that when they do dig it, they're getting more roots in that ball.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so when you dig it out of your yard, you're digging that root system. You're leaving so much of the root system behind. And in order to get enough of that root system to take it with, the soil ball would be way too heavy for you to be able to move it without heavy equipment.
You couldn't roll it out onto a tarp and drag it?
No, because then you'd probably break off the soil and the roots in the process. That's why they ball and burlap them.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Michelle in Black River Falls, on to you now. Hi, Michelle.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about growing succulents. I love to grow things like hens and chicks, but they show them in catalogs and stuff, and they look so thick and beautiful, but mine are kind of sparse, and I don't know if it's because they have too good a soil or
yes.
What?
It probably is. If you know your soil and you know you have pretty rich soil, they don't like real rich soil. They don't like real moist soil, certainly, and they like really, really well-drained soil, and then full sun for those succulents. So if you're not providing all three of those things, that may be why they're not spreading like you'd like them to. They may be hanging on, but not spreading like you'd like them to.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. Sharon in Cuba City, hello to you.
Good morning.
Hi.
Or good afternoon, rather.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question. You were telling somebody about a colorful tree for her garden, I believe it was, or for her yard.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of the name of it. She talked about a redbud tree, and you told her, no, not for this area, but this other one. And I know this is native to Wisconsin.
Well, one of the ones I suggested was the serviceberry or Juneberry.
That's it, yes. Where do I find that?
Oh, it should be pretty easy to find. And there are a couple of different species and cultivars that you can get. The Amelanchier, Amelanchier, is the genus name for the serviceberry.
Okay.
And Amelanchier X grandiflora is one that's a natural hybrid cross that actually has had a cultivar selection, Brilliance. And that should be available in Wisconsin nurseries because it was a Wisconsin selection and has beautiful, larger white spring flowers than some of the other serviceberries. Usually a multi-stem small tree, nice gray bark with some kind of darker gray striping in it. The leaves are kind of a bluish-green. And the fruit forms in June, beautiful blue fruit that the birds love, and yet it's not terribly messy. And then in the fall, it has beautiful reddish-orange fall color.
Okay, well, it was recommended to me for the fruit.
Oh, yeah.
You can
eat
use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I always think of Yule Gibbons when I think of that plant because his famous quote about was that you have to beat the birds to the fruit because they love it so much, you hardly ever get any for yourself.
Okay, well, I sent for some one time, and they finally bloomed, and they are pussy willows.
Oh. And you know that that's not the same thing.
That is not the same thing. Sharon, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And Sharon Morrissey, thank you so much. Boy, that time flew.
It sure does. Great listeners, great questions, and everybody's ready for spring.
We'll look forward to your next visit. Thanks, Sharon.
Thank you.
Sharon Morrissey, UW Extension, Milwaukee County UW Extension Horticulture Educator. Really pleased to have her along, and we'll have her back, and we will talk with her again. I can promise you that. Coming up on Monday, just to let you know, our UW physical therapists, Bill Boisenault and Lori Tyne Brody, will be on to talk about your aches and pains and sprains and strains. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.